This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Hey, Chicago. I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the top stories across the Chicago area later in this episode. But first, advocates are warning that the First Amendment right to freedom of the press is under attack.
Former CNN anchor Don Lemon was arrested on federal charges tied to a protest at a church. Says he was reporting as a journalist when demonstrators interrupted a service to protest immigration enforcement.
The FBI has raided the home of a Washington Post journalist who's been covering the Trump administration's federal government firing since he took office. The FBI took a phone, two laptops, and a watch.
Washington Post is laying off a third of its workforce across both the newsroom and its business operations. The cuts reportedly affect more than 300 of the approximately 800 journalists.
In a few minutes, we'll hear from two people who care quite a bit about press freedom and your access to journalism, including actor John Cusack. Joining me now in the studio is talk show senior producer Meha Ahmed. Meha, good to see you.
Hey, Sasha.
So John Cusack, we know him from films like High Fidelity and Say Anything, but this is different. This is not what he was here to talk about.
As the host, you know that a lot of times when we have, you know, people from Hollywood and actors come on the show, it's to talk about a new project that they're working on.
Right.
But what really caught our eye was John Cusack wrote an op-ed in the Sun-Times about access to good journalism and the gatekeeping of journalism and the threat to press freedom at large. As he says, it's the only private enterprise that is actually explicitly named and protected in the Constitution, you know, demonstrating that's essential to a functioning democracy because no one can make decisions about their lives and their country if they're not informed. And part of what he sees as a threat to that is paywalls. So we invited him onto the show to find out more about the work that he does in this space and how he views this current moment for the country and for the press industry at large.
Yeah, it was really interesting reading what he wrote in the Sun-Times. I, too, was surprised. I said, John Cusack writing about paywalls. Very interesting, because I think as journalists, of course, we know we care a lot about access, right? That's kind of what we do. We put the information out. We want to be able to give it to everyone. And we here, we are public radio journalists. We are attached to the Chicago Sun-Times, right? And so it's clear we don't believe in paywalls, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are no paywalls here.
None.
You know, so we're on the same page. And so John Cusack and Seth Stern, he's with the Freedom of the Press Foundation. They're making the case that these paywalls create a two-tiered citizenry where some people can afford the information and some can't. And usually the people who can't gain access to that information, who can't afford to pay for monthly subscriptions to the New York Times, those are the people who need the information the most.
And of course, this conversation comes so soon after we saw mass layoffs at the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we had to ask John about that as well. Let's get to it. Yep. Meha, thank you so much.
No problem.
I sat down with actor, writer, producer, and activist John Cusack. He's a founding board member for the Freedom of the Press Foundation and recently wrote an op-ed in the Sun-Times about the need for more paywall-free news, particularly reporting based on Freedom of Information Act requests, or FOIAs. And we talked with Seth Stern, Chief of Advocacy for the Freedom of the Press Foundation. John kicked things off with more on why he's so involved in this issue.
Let's see, 2010 or 11, I think, a bunch of us got together and we were concerned about the PayPal blockade to WikiLeaks. that was sort of a bipartisan thing, and we thought that that was a bad idea. And we got together and we thought, well, let's beat this blockade by forming an organization. But for various reasons, we didn't want to be known as the Julian Assange Super PAC. So we said, let's use this because we want to make a broad umbrella organization based on the rights and principles, because, you know, you don't need a weatherman to see which way the wind was blowing back then and still to this day. So we started it, and it's been a terrific organization. It's done a lot of great things.
Let's talk about this day, as you mentioned. How would you describe the current moment when it comes to the news industry?
Nowhere to go but up.
So where would you say it's at? It's at the bottom, but what does that look like to you?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of issues there. Access journalism, subservient journalism, consolidation of corporate media, all those things, of course, play into it. But I think one of the fulcrum points we pointed out was the idea that paywalls are creating sort of a tiered citizenry where they can get where people can get news and not. And with the advent of AI and with the knowledge that Silicon Valley and your tech overlords, your friendly tech overlords, want to keep people confused. They want to keep them addicted to junk, and they want to keep them talking about anything but billionaires paying tax. They'll literally go do anything to keep you from talking about politics that may possibly affect them. And I think that's been pretty proven. So with the advent, you know, now we have AI where I saw Professor John Mersheimer from University of Chicago is in a big thing with Instagram because he's been very popular as being a very staunch anti-war but realist about the wars in Ukraine and in Gaza and around the world in geopolitics. And there are now deep fakes of him saying things that he doesn't believe that are now getting as much views as his real thing. So given this whole, you know, perfect storm that's, I think, damaging media, I think one thing we can do with this in this situation is try to get FOIA-based reporting, right? Beyond the paywalls, or certainly beyond, like after a week or two, I don't see any reason why this reporting shouldn't be free, because the right to know becomes a privilege. So as Seth and I were talking, you know, if somebody's during the ICE raids and Midway Blitz, you know, if you're making $40,000 a year, you're not going to be able to pay for the information you need to know what are your rights, who was arrested, where are they. So, you know, it's a perverse thing that the FOIA-based reporting would be behind a paywall because the entire premise is based on it's our information. Mm-hmm. The government is preserving this information for us. We have a right to know.
And therefore, we should have access for all.
Correct. Now, we know the problems in the journalism industry as a business, but, you know, it's not just a business because no other business is protected in the Constitution because it's a right and a fundamental need for self-governance.
Yeah. Seth, what comes to mind for you? You nodded through some of John's sentiments.
No, that was great. Another point to emphasize is that although many assume that taking content outside of paywalls is bad for business, that has not proven to be the case. A couple of outlets that have unpaywalled their FOIA-based reporting, Wired, 404 Media, have told us at events that Freedom the Press Foundation has hosted that unpaywalling and publicizing the decision to unpaywall unlocked revenue, drove subscribers, drove goodwill, drove donations. Outlets really benefit from this because it builds public trust. And the truth is very few people are paying for news because they can't find another way to get information. They're paying for news because they want to support outlets that they think are doing good work and that are important to them. As John was saying, when you look at the state of the information landscape, sure, people have for years been saying, well, I don't need to pay for news. There's free information all over the internet. as that information gets junkier and junkier, as deepfakes become more prevalent, as AI slop is everywhere, I think that pendulum's going to swing in the other direction. People are going to say, I'm tired of having to figure out whether everything I see online is real. Mm-hmm. I want to have a reliable source of information. And they're going to go back to names that they can trust.
Through misinformation is difficult.
Right. Well, you know, right. When you have that tiered access, you know, and people can't get the news, the void is filled with disinformation, lies, propaganda, and basically just junk. And to, you know, piggyback on what Seth was saying, one of our board members is Katie Drummond, who's the global editor of Wired. And she took the challenge to made a calculated risk to tell everybody she was going to unpaywall her FOIA-based reporting, which is the real hard news. You know, you want to keep interviews with actors or entertainers or celebrities, yeah, put it behind a paywall. But the stuff that people need as citizens, she made that calculated bet, and she said it succeeded beyond her wildest imaginations. Her subscriptions went up. People were grateful. So it's not only the right thing to do. We're arguing that it's good business. So it could be a win-win. But right now you have very, very intelligent people who are very confused by what's news and what's not. So our argument is let's have the newspapers be the place and the journalists and the media companies that are doing that work. Let's have people remember, okay, we go to them. We don't go to Instagram for our news.
Well, you know, the Post, as I mentioned, recently laid off nearly 30% of its staff. Having Jeff Bezos bankrolling the operation didn't necessarily prevent journalists from losing their jobs, Seth.
No, it didn't. I think there are a number of assumptions that the events of the Trump administration have shattered, and one of them is the assumption that billionaires will operate news outlets in the public's interest out of a sense of altruism and public service. That is not the case. Billionaires might be hands-off to an extent when there is no reason for them to be hands-on, but when they're choosing between their business interests, whether in the case of the Washington Post, which is looking to get on Trump's good side by platforming, you know, Melania and Jeff Bezos's other company, Amazon, or Paramount, which is putting the interests of its corporate transactions ahead of the interests of its newsrooms. Disney, which probably values its theme parks as a far more lucrative business than his newsrooms, and wants to get on the administration's good side. So you're seeing billionaire-owned and corporate-owned conglomerates sabotage the editorial end of their operations. And then when it comes down to just regular business, they're treating it like any other asset. They're laying off the positions that they don't see as profitable in the very short term. They have no sense or no appreciation for the public value of news and the responsibility that comes with ownership of an outlet like the Washington Post that has that rich history that, you know, needs to be preserved and needs to be kept in a condition where it can continue being the Washington Post. The editorial page has already been sabotaged through censorship, the newsroom now through layoffs. And of course, Jeff Bezos could very easily inject some funds into the Washington Post to keep it viable. It would be nothing to him, a drop in the bucket, but he's unwilling to do so.
Seth, talk more about the Freedom of the Press Foundation and just the on-the-ground practical work that you folks do.
Sure. Well, I run the advocacy operation with a small team of attorneys and career press freedom advocates. We engage in legislative advocacy to advance legislation that is favorable to the press and stop more often legislation that is not favorable to the press. We write a lot of op-eds, do a lot of media, and try to get press freedom to the top of the public discourse, build appreciation across political divides of the fundamental nature of the free press. Because even those who don't like the media, don't like the mainstream media, how do they even know they don't like the mainstream media? They know because they know because of Freedom of the Press. They know because someone else had the freedom to point out what they perceive as flaws in the mainstream media. So we are all dependent on freedom of the press. Nobody gathers their own news, just like nobody paves their own roads. You need a journalist to do that.
You know, we're also living in a time when the president of the United States is almost daily attacking journalists and suing news organizations for coverage that he finds unfair. We've also seen the funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting clawed back by Congress. We saw what that did to CPB afterwards. What effect would you say the Trump administration is having on press freedom and just the ability of the press to do its job, John?
Well, I think you've seen from a mainstream point of view, it took the New York Times, I think, 3.5 years to call Trump's lies. And they use the word mistruth or, you know, alternate facts and all those things. So, you know, the owner-donor class of the legacy media, let's face it, they've collapsed as cowards for the most part. The individual journalists are always doing good work. It's not that. It's the editors, I think, and the people calling those shots. I think there's a lot of pushback as well, and there's some who are holding the line, but it's dark.
Mm. What's the biggest threat to the press right now, Seth?
Well,
besides fascism,
more or less. It's hard to identify one, but the Hannah Nathanson raid has a lot of people very concerned about the potential that the Espionage Act could be weaponized against journalists who publish government leaks. Unauthorized information from the government, which is a constitutional right of journalists, but you've got this 100-year-old statute that the administration reads otherwise. And we've got a Supreme Court in place that is, let's say, unpredictable. So I don't know where the Nathanson raid will go. In the past, the Espionage Act has mostly been wielded against journalist sources as opposed to journalists themselves, the exception being Julian Assange. Whether you consider him a journalist or not isn't really the point. The conduct he was charged with is the same thing, journalist, obtaining documents and publishing them. Are we going to see that expanded to more traditional journalists? Of course, everything we're seeing coming out of Brendan Carr and the FCC is highly alarming. He's essentially running the FCC as a shakedown racket to beat licensees into compliance with Trump's policies. He has redefined the public interest rule as license for the FCC to police the content of news outlets, but he won't tell the news outlets what he sees the public interest as being. You have to guess at rules that reside only in his head. You don't know what he'll criminalize next or what he'll penalize next. All you really know is that the best way to stay on Brendan Carr's good side is to not upset Donald Trump. So there is an incentive to do that. What we're seeing is an administration that is finding any reason it can to target journalists. Yeah. Usually targeting journalists is a last resort. Prosecutors sort of recognize that, one, there will be political backlash to targeting journalists, and two, that it is not in the interest of justice to prosecute journalists when there is an alternative, when it's not needed. That's why you see when journalists are arrested at protests, usually the charges get dropped pretty quickly. We're seeing the opposite now. We're seeing an administration that is burning the midnight oil, finding any excuse it can to target journalists and their sources. So sure, that's creating a climate of self-censorship. And the thing with self-censorship is we don't know what news we haven't read because of it. We only know what we read. We don't know what we don't know.
And I think they're very clever in exploiting flaws that were there before the administration. Our organization's been working, 10, 12 years now, something like that? And case after case of the Espionage Act, it's an antiquated old law based in World War I. And it was being used to basically scare the hell or bludgeon whistleblowers and their sources. And there, it's usually around national security issues, war and peace, and state secrets that, firmly fall in the public's right to know. Whatever you think of Mr. Assange, collateral damage video, that was the gig.
Yeah.
That was the gig where they thought, okay, this in the Iraq war was being, we were getting balloons and celebrations and people looking at, look at those beautiful rockets. And it was, basically bullshit propaganda.
Yeah.
And so that was what he released. And the state said, oh, no, 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 no. We're going to come down hard on you. And they were using the Espionage Act. So Trump's just blown through that. I mean, they're just all blown right through those doors. They don't even have any pretense anymore. They'll go after anyone. I mean, look, we're in a situation where we have masked goons killing people on the streets, and we all know our history, so we know this only goes one way.
And so, given some of what we're talking about here, a good amount of skepticism, I think, is probably wise and healthy as we, peruse on the interwebs. I think, though, for a lot of people, it's crossed over into this severe mistrust.
Well, also, like when the newspapers give in to an extortion from the Trump administration and pay ransom money instead of standing on principles and saying, no, we've been here for 200 years, go to hell.
Mm. But people and people aren't just mistrusting the government. They're not trusting news outlets as well. So how do outlets build that trust back in this polarized environment?
On paywall important news so we can get that trust back.
Yeah, and take credit when you're right. I think the way to get through it is good reporting.
And also, as they say, and putting heat and accountability into the editors, the owner, donor class, because, they say there's no neutral walls in a museum. Well, there's no neutral front pages.
You know,
what gets covered and why it gets in the papers. There has to be a fiduciary sense of public goodwill and public trust that I think existed in this country in my lifetime at a much higher level than what we have today.
Now let's turn to some of the biggest local stories of the day. At the table to help us break them down was Claire Lane, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor, and Michael Puente, WBEZ reporter and weekend anchor. First item on the agenda, Chicago is happy to see some warmer weather. Claire, kick things off.
The doggy was sleeping outside.
Oh,
it was
doggy.
Fantastic. I finally wanted to walk my dog outside.
We should have believed Woodstock Willie. We talked about this on Groundhog Day. Willie said it's going to be spring before we know it.
It's a false spring, Claire. Stop lying to the people.
I'm just trusting the groundhog.
But a record could be reached today.
This is correct. So the warmest February 16th that is recorded was set back in 1921, and that was 58 degrees.
Oh, wow. I remember that day.
National Weather Service forecasting today the high to be 62-63. So if we reach that at O'Hare, we will officially break the record for February 16th warmest day. And it's going to continue the unseasonably warm weather throughout this week. We could see 64 degrees by Wednesday.
Well, maybe I'll participate because I'm still wearing the big coat. Not letting go. Right. In other news, in this face-off that we've seen over the last several months between ICE and religious clergy, Claire, clergy seems to have gotten a major win on Friday. What happened?
This is correct. A federal judge ordered the Department of Homeland Security to allow clergy access to the Immigration Processing Center, as we know in Broadview, because Ash Wednesday is this week, I believe.
It is.
It's on Wednesday.
Yeah.
So the ruling, as we know, is part of an ongoing lawsuit. You've covered this extensively in your show, Sasha, of clergy just wanting to sort of be able to give people access to their services, offer communion, and they were being shut out. So the judge says clergy should be allowed to administer communion and offer ashes to those who want it on Wednesday. Mm. Clergy members and several Catholic sisters filed a lawsuit back in November alleging that DHS, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also other senior federal officials, unlawfully blocked them from providing any religious ministry to any detainees at Broadview. So the lawsuit accuses the federal government of violating that First Amendment Act.
Okay. Well, the partial government shutdown that we knew was coming, Michael, it's here. It began over the weekend. Today is officially day three. And it's led to this pause in funding for the Department of Homeland Security. Catch us up.
Well, that's right. There's some funding for much of the Homeland Security, except for TSA workers. So at Midway, O'Hare, and other major airports, they are working without pay. So that could lead to longer security lines when you go to the airport. And this is already their third time having to face this. So they are definitely feeling the impacts of this government shutdown. Mm-hmm. Who can go that long without a paycheck? So they're being used as pawns again. But air traffic controllers, they're not expected to be affected as their funding was already enacted. But as this goes along, you got to think some of these folks may just say, I can't show up to work. Yeah. I'm not getting paid.
We have seen this before. We're going to be talking extensively about the topic with Congressman Chuy Garcia in the next hour on Say More. So stay tuned here on WBEZ at 10 o'clock. One more ICE-related headline, Claire. A federal judge on Friday also ruled against immigration agents making warrantless arrests.
That's correct. A federal judge ruled against ICE over a memo that was granting agents essentially that power to make these arrests without probable cause. Mm-hmm. So the judge ruled on Friday that U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement agents now must follow a consent decree that restricts their ability to arrest non-citizens. They need a warrant. They also would need probable cause. Block reporting that the judge said that the internal memo that circulated throughout ICE last month was pretty inconsistent with existing law, especially here in Illinois.
Especially the fact that they've been getting away with warrantless arrests makes me want to shake my head. In election news, Mike, we are just about a month away from that Illinois primary election, and a new bill was just introduced in Springfield around voting rights. What should we know?
Well, that's right, Sasha. You know, there's a sweeping voting rights legislation emerged just last week and it basically strengthens the hands of Illinois judges to take control of disputes over things like redistricting and giving expanded safeguards to non-English speaking voters. This bill is sponsored by State Senator Graciela Guzman of Chicago. She's a Democrat. So it basically codifies much of the Federal Voting Rights Act into state law as an insurance in case the law is repealed by Republicans in Congress.
So if passed, when would it go into effect?
July 1st.
July 1st.
If it passes.
Yeah. What's the latest, Claire, on the efforts to ban some hemp products in Chicago? That's come up lately.
Right. So hemp here to stay for now. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, and I know you asked him about this when he was on your show last week during Ask the Mayor exclusively.
Yeah, I said, will you veto this?
And he did. So, and this is the second veto of his tenure. This time it was an ordinance that would have banned the sale of certain hemp products across the city. So that measure passed with 32 votes and really was meant to crack down on some scofflaws that were selling the intoxicating hemp products and at times to children. But as we know, lots of local and small businesses would have been really impacted by that. Mm-hmm. So Johnson says, though he shares the concerns about kids and their access to some of these intoxicating hemp products, he says a broad ban would have had a disproportionate impact on small businesses. So he's going with the money here.
I had a feeling he was pretty much, you know, leaning towards it. I have lots of concerns with this, but I'm going to take some time to, you know, read through the details before I make my decision.
And as we know, you know, marijuana and hemp in our state and in our city has been pretty lucrative and helped out a lot of pension.
Mm-hmm. So the status right now of these products moving forward?
As far as we know, aldermen are saying they don't have the support to override the veto. Okay. So veto is going to veto.
The veto is going to veto. What else are you following?
We've been watching Olympics a little bit, some of us. The women's U.S. team has been just totally dominating the ice. I mean, they've shut everybody out. I think they've had one goal scored against them at this point.
Wow.
They shut out Italy 6-0 on Friday. Illinois native Abby Murphy was actually, once again, she's a feisty player. I think she's from Evergreen Park. She's been playing for Minnesota, but she has been all over the ice, checking people left and right, getting into the action. She told ESPN a pretty good article that her coach has been telling her, don't get in trouble, don't do anything stupid. You got to keep going to the next game, and that's exactly what they're going to do.
Oh, wow.
So Team USA taking on Sweden, 9:40 this morning.
Is Canada still in there?
I don't believe that they are in contention for a medal. But that's your turf. I should be paying attention to this.
You should be playing.
Speaking of feisty, I need to lace up my skates.
Girls, come on, call me. You forgot my number, apparently. Speaking of, you know, everybody's been into the Olympics. I've been watching, too, and just catching little bits. You know, not watching as closely as I should, but I did, I guess, learn about a new sport that I didn't know about. Skeleton?
Yes.
What is that?
It's one of the most fearless of the Winter Olympics.
I'm fascinated.
I mean, you're essentially, it's like a bobsled, but it's just a single man and you're a lot less covered.
Stomach.
And people have been showing their fashion with their skeleton helmet choices we've been seeing. Also some political controversy. But speaking of Canada, there's some curling controversy,
Sasha, being accused
of cheating. I don't know if you've seen the photos of this, Mike.
A little bit. I guess there's a one of the players is, I don't know too many of the details, but there's a curling cheating scandal. Maybe you know more about it.
He's using a little bit more of a push than maybe he's allowed.
Oh, using a little bit more of a push.
Yeah, you see, I mean, has that been proven that, that he was cheating?
No. Well, they said there's some kind of videos that's showing him doing this.
There's video evidence? Never mind.
Yeah, but, you know.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Have you been paying attention, Michael?
I have been. I think everything is pretty much fascinating. I think over the weekend, I think everybody was kind of shocked that Ilya Malinin, the men's figure skating, who's supposed to just, who's called the quad god, was supposed to win gold, and he had a tough outing there on Saturday and finished eighth. But he's still amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just takes it can really get to some people. But you see some of the downhill people, and we have a number of people still from Illinois. You have Sarah Warren of Willowbrook. She made her Olympic debut just yesterday, skating in the 500-meter race. She finished with a time of 39.19 seconds, good for 28th place. And Ethan Ciprin of Glen Ellen and Emery Lehman of Oak Park are both set to compete in the team pursuit tomorrow. So
Illinois is well represented there,
absolutely.
Though.
Absolutely.
Nice.
Yes.
How are my Jamaican bobsledders doing?
You know, I wish I could say I know exactly where they are positioned.
You haven't been paying attention?
Well, half the time I'm watching, it's either really early when I'm anchoring on the weekends, I'm looking up a little bit, or when I'm on my couch half asleep. So like, wake up.
I'm just mad I missed the majority of the figure skating, but, you know, there's always next year.
Always next year.
All right, Michael Puente, WBEZ reporter and weekend news anchor, and Claire Lane, WBEZ's morning edition anchor.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Maha Ahmed, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. If you like what you just heard, we hope you join us for more. We drop a new episode about Chicago news and culture every weekday afternoon, including our weekly news recap on Fridays. And once a month, Ask the Mayor. Thanks for listening and have a great day.